I'd like to call this meeting of the House Transportation Committee to order. It is 1:42 on Thursday, February 5. Members present include Representative McCabe, Representative St. Clair, Representative Mina, Representative Nelson, Representative Stutes, Co-Chair Eichheit, and myself, Co-Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business, and please take this time to silence your cell phone before the meeting. Before we begin, I'd also like to thank Jordan Nicholson from House Records and Susan Quigley from the, Zachary Lawhorn from the Juno LIO for staffing our committee today. Also our committee aides Griffin Sukeo and Meredith Trainer. As a reminder for folks in the audience, if you have a note you would like to pass, please get the attention of our committee aides instead of approaching the dais. I'd also like to, at this time, recognize and invite Representative Himshute to come join us at the table for today's presentation. And I'd like to recognize that today, in addition to our invited guests, in our audience we are joined by Fran Houston, an elder and spokeswoman for the Akwan. Thank you for being here today. On today's agenda, we have an overview of the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board from Juanetta Ayers, chair of the AMHOB, and Anthony Lindoff, the vice chair of the AMHOB. After that, we do have a presentation on the Alaska Marine Highway Systems Cascade Point Project from Craig Tornga, the Marine Director, and Chris Goins, the South Coast Director. And we are also joined today by Andy Mills, our legislative liaison, and Catherine Keith, the Deputy Commissioner. So I'd like to first welcome Ms. Ayers and Mr. Lindhoff to please introduce yourself for the record and begin your overview. For time's sake, just know that we plan to spend about 20 to 30 minutes maximum on this portion of the presentation today before getting to DOT. Thank you for joining us. We can't hear you, Ms. Ayers, if you're speaking yet. Very brief at ease while we get the technology figured out. Technology challenge there. Ms. Ayers, sorry for mispronouncing your name. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Great. We can hear you too.
Great. Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Chair Carrick and members of the House Transportation Committee. It's a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you for this opportunity. So for the record, my name is Juanetta Ayers. I am the chair of the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board. I'm a resident here in Anchorage. And I want to start by recognizing my fellow board members. Joining me today is also our vice chair, Anthony Lindhoff. And we'll hopefully be hearing him as we proceed with the comment period, the question period. But we also have other members of the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board who have volunteered to serve six-year terms on the board and to work on behalf of Alaska's coastal communities and the Alaska Marine Highway System. And I just want to emphasize that we are all volunteer and that we've taken on these appointments because of our shared commitment to a sustainable and successful Alaska Marine Highway. I also want to thank Commissioner Ryan Anderson for the support and resources that it provided to the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board by the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And the board has been critical to the board's ability to do its job. And I'd also like to thank Craig Tornga, director of the Alaska Marine Highway, and to his staff for the information, responsiveness, and the support that they provide to the board so that we can fulfill our statutory responsibilities. So today, I'd like to focus on three things, a brief history of the governance of the operations board, the history and governance of the operations board, the progress that has been made to stabilize and modernize the Alaska. And then what I think are the most critical issues before the Alaska Marine Highway System moving forward, and I'm going to pause there and see if there's any further direction from the committee before we dive in.
I think we don't have any questions yet, Ms. Ayers, if you'd like to continue.
Great, thank you. So with governance, the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board, and I'm going to apologize to everybody, I'm going to switch to just calling it the acronym AMHOB, it's a mouthful. So the AMHOB was created in the 2021 legislative session in HB 63, with an effective date of January 1st, 2022. The board was populated by both executive and legislative appointments, and we began our first meetings in May of 2022. So as with any new organization, the board went through the process of forming, storming, and norming. That process always takes a little bit of time with a new organization. But early on, the board was meeting several times a month. It was a quite accelerated schedule and required a big commitment on the part of the DOT staff, AMHS staff, and the board members. And this to accelerate our shared understanding of the challenges before us about the Alaska Marine Highway, our tasking from the enabling statute, and how to develop norms about how the board was going to operate collectively. During this time, I want to point to Senator Kaufman and his staff, who spent a good deal of time with myself and our prior chair, Shirley Marquardt, throughout this period to better understand the legislative intent and to detail what the board's responsibilities are with a racy chart. Those statutory directives and authorities assigned to the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board, what we're responsible for, what we're accountable for, what we should do in consultation with the department, and what we need to be informed about. So that RACI chart is a part of the AMHOB webpage, and it is a document that is now included in all of our board packets as a reminder as to what our role is as an organization. So last year, the legislature reaffirmed its intent to maintain the AMHOB structure with both legislative and executive appointees. And during that process, we became aware that the board was not viewed positively by Commissioner Anderson in terms of providing valuable advice or consultation. So as a result, we've worked hard to summarize our meetings in writing to the commissioner, generally within a week of each meeting. And that the intent there is to provide a more productive dialogue with the commissioner and to fulfill our role as envisioned in statute. And we welcome more two-way communication in this regard. So I want to turn now to operational status. Now, I have had an opportunity to preview the slide deck that you'll be looking at in a few minutes. And so I'm going to abbreviate this section just for the sake of time. But I think the headline here is that the Alaska Marine Highway operational status is improving, despite a lot of ongoing challenges with, and usually we say an aging fleet, but I am going to say an aged fleet, an inherited misalignment and underutilization of the Alaska class ferries, workforce challenges that are pervasive across all organizations and sectors, but it's especially so in the marine sector where workforce has a lot of mobility across the globe. And of course, we've been operating in an escalating price environment throughout the time that the AMHOB has been in existence, and it's continuing. So these are all challenges that really complicate the future of the Alaska Marine Highway System, stabilizing it and achieving sustainability. As I said, I'm going to abbreviate my comments here, but I do want to add that I applaud Commissioner Anderson for finding and naming Craig Tornga to lead the Alaska Marine Highway System. I think Mr. Tornga is the right leader at this time for the AMHS. His management skills, his demeanor, and his openness have been recognized and appreciated by the board, and I think contributed greatly to our deliberations, our understanding of the challenges and the current status of the system. And he's very responsive to our inquiries. He spent a lot of time with the board over the last 4 years. He provides very thorough answers, and he's shown a consistent openness and willingness to listen and consider diverse viewpoints. So we are very appreciative of his contributions to the board's process. So with regard to challenges, I had planned slightly different remarks, but the headlines of the week really probably beg that we start with the funding challenges. And they are considerable. They continue to be considerable. The board has long known that the federal rural ferry money that are a significant portion of the operating funds for the system the last few years are not a sure thing. As federal funds, we understand that there's always some contingencies and possibilities that those funds may not be available. We had Senator Murkowski's transportation staffer slated to address this on January 23rd. Unfortunately, that meeting did not continue, did not proceed because we were not able to get department support for it due to the other challenges that the department was addressing. However, in speaking to Senator Murkowski's transportation lead directly, I can't really provide any additional information other than what you've really already heard. There is a commitment between Secretary Duffy and Senator Murkowski that the funds will be released this spring. And I will say that I spoke to Senator Murkowski directly in December about the same issue. She remained optimistic, but grounded in the reality that there is no order when it comes to federal funds in this time period. So the normal grant making processes have been highly disrupted, and it's regretful and unfortunate. I will say that the board has a commitment to explore other funding and look for opportunities to understand what other partnerships may be available across other federal sources like tribal transportation funds. And we do have on our agenda, our forward-looking agenda, to have folks from Department of Transportation and BIA to address us on those issues. Those are not scheduled yet, but that's the board's intent. Other than that, I would say that the next big challenge is fleet modernization. That's part of the long-range plan that I know you'll be hearing about and has been a Marine Highway Operations Board over the first 3 years of its existence. And fleet modernization is perhaps the most critical thing confronting the system, aside from all the other challenges that we've discussed. But in order to optimize the system, the Tadlina and the Hubbard have to be interoperable, and those projects really have to be concluded, is particularly with the Tadlina still being queued up for crew quarters. That's a long delayed project, and the small community service will never be fully optimized until both vessels are fully online and interoperable. Finally, I'll just say that the rest of fleet modernization is again a critical issue, and we have been long delayed with the Tessamina replacement vessel, and it was welcome news to see that the construction bidding period is now open as of about a week or so ago. And so we're hopeful that the shipyards will be responsive and that we will soon be under contract with a Tessamina replacement vessel. The biggest concern there is that the IIJA money and the time on that. I know that there's a great deal of concern within the definition that the funds have not really been encumbered in a way that really truly secures them. And so we really need to move forward on particularly the Tuscumina replacement vessel, which has been long awaited. And as I mentioned, welcome news to see that it is currently open for construction bids. With that, I'm just going to conclude my remarks, and I'll pause there and ask Vice Chair Lindoff if he has anything that he would like to add.
Thank you, Vice Chair Lindoff.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair Carrick. And I don't know how much I can add other than just I'm a staunch cheerleader for our Madam Chair here, Ayers. And I can echo her remarks regarding Mr. Torunga and certainly the fleet modernization. So I'll just quickly introduce myself. I am the Vice Chair of AMHOB, recently appointed, I should say. I think my began in maybe about a year and a half ago, I believe. And so just it's been a whirlwind and learning quite a bit, a lot from Mrs. Ayers here, and an honor to be here, and am I guess here at your leisure. I mean, if you have any questions, I'm happy to oblige.
We have a question from Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I'm not sure if this question will go to you or to Ms. Ayers, but I'm intimately familiar with the AMHOB legislation. And if I'm not mistaken, a report annually is required from the AMHOB board to the legislature via the Department of Transportation. And I might be incorrect on this, but I would like to have it verified either yay or nay that the report in fact was submitted to the Department of Transportation, but I believe there were some changes made there prior to it coming to the legislature. Can you expound on that or give me an idea what those changes were that were made in that report prior to it coming to the legislature?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, I think there's probably two processes that are being merged into one here. We are required by statute to provide an annual report. That process was delayed by the cancellation of our January 23rd meeting, but we do hope to have that to the legislature no later than April. At this point, it doesn't appear that we will be able to reschedule that meeting before that date. It does require at least some deliberation and input from the other board members. We have had, as I have said, a series of summary letters with three meetings that will probably serve as the bulk of that report, but I'm sure that with some of the funding issues that have become more prominent in the last week or so, that the board will want to reflect on those as well. The second process, which is in regard to the long-range plan, which again was a major focus for the AMHOB over the first 3 years of its existence, and was recently concluded. The plan was modified. The board reviewed it, and now I'm forgetting my timing, but it is summarized in an October letter to the commissioner, and we did copy legislative leadership on that. The board recommended the long-range plan in one form, and then when it came out in the public, it was slightly altered in key areas. And so at our October meeting in 2025, we did note that those changes took place and that they altered the long-range plan from the perspective of the board. And that also triggered one of our statutory authorities, which was to say that there was a deviation from the plan. We did hear from Commissioner Anderson that that was not his read on that situation. And I believe if you don't have a copy of that, I'm sure it can be made available to you. I believe that with the exception of the fact that we have not been able to finalize an annual report statement to the legislature for the prior year, we have exercised our statutory responsibilities according to our understanding. I will also add that I did confer with Senator Kaufman on the October 25 letter because he was very specific about that process when we were engaged with him in 2022 and 23 about defining how the board operates. And if I could also just add an editorial note here, Senator Kaufman, and I know Representative Stutes, I'm not sure who else on the committee may have been involved in that original legislation, but there was an intent in the way that it was structured for it to be slightly different than just a typical advisory board by giving us that component in the statute to issue a corrective action notice.
Follow up. So just so I'm clear, am I to understand that long-range plan report, the recommendations of the MHOB board were altered by the Department of Transportation?
Well, through the chair, Representative Stutes, the board endorsed the plan as it was prepared and written as we saw it at our April or July meeting in 25. And when it was made public, there were several places where it was altered, and we became aware of that at our October 25 meeting. And the board discussed the matter and felt that it was materially different than what we had endorsed.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take maybe one or two more questions total before I move to DOT. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Ms. Ayers, through the chair. So what can you describe maybe one of the or two of the major alterations that you saw to that report and how they were altered compared to what the AMHOB wanted?
I can. It is on a letter that is posted on the AMHOB webpage, and it's labeled corrective action. There were some wording changes where there were three specifically, one where the original wording was a continuation of the Cascade Point feasibility study. Was changed to continuation of the build-out of the Cascade Point Ferry Terminal. The second reads, the funding and schedule for the construction of the new Cascade Point Ferry Terminal was not included due to the ongoing feasibility study. That was the original wording. The final wording was construction of the new Cascade Point Ferry Terminal has begun using existing state appropriations. The work will continue seeking out federal grants and other appropriate funding sources. The third and final version, the original wording was terminal lease payments for project costs related to the proposed Cascade Point Ferry Terminal are not included in the 2045 long-range plan due to feasibility study ongoing as of the 2045 LRP adoption long-range plan. And the final wording was changed to terminal lease payments or project costs related to the proposed Cascade Point Ferry Terminal are not included in the 2045 LRP due to the timing of the LRP and recent decisions to move forward with the terminal facility.
Follow up. So it sounds to me like, I'm sort of famous for ripping the Band-Aid off the wound, but it sounds to me like the AMHOB is not in favor of Cascade Point. Would that be a fair statement?
The AMHOB has not taken a position pro or con on Cascade Point. Our request in April of 24 was for a business case study. Typically, that kind of study would be, you know, a base case, do nothing, and then several alternatives with some level of evaluation and rigor as a sort of a stage gate process to determine whether or not to proceed. We, throughout the time of the development of the long-range plan, we did periodically have information presented to us about Cascade Point, but the business case had not been made. There was no cost-benefit analysis that said this is the preferred alternative and we should proceed with that. And that's really where I think, I mean, again, the minutes of the AMHOP for that April 24 meeting would be indicative of where the board was. I believe there was actually an official, I know there was a motion, and it may not have been a resolution, but there was a motion. And so the board has not taken a position on Cascade Point, and I think that's material here because, you know, the question that there are huge capital needs across the Alaska Marine Highway System, and the prioritization of capital may not be, and I think if you look at Commissioner Anderson's letter to us in response to the October 25 letter was that it's not the AMHOP's job to allocate capital, and truly it is not, but our reflection is that there are huge capital needs across the Alaska Marine Highway System, and the prioritization of capital for something that technically was not included in the long-range plan when we looked at it, at the degree to which we see it proceeding, and it's just it is not in a process or a project development process that we're familiar with in making those kinds of big capital allocation decisions, especially on an accelerated basis.
Thanks. So one more, if you don't mind.
Follow up.
So the AMHOB Operations Board would seem to not be, and maybe I'm wrong, but it would seem to not be in your purview to worry about big capital outlays such as roads and ferry terminals and that sort of thing. Your Operations Board, I kind of did a business plan myself right here on the LeConte at 188 gallons an hour. If we built Cascade Point, would probably take, for 33 cars, which is the max on the LeConte, would take 66 gallons of auto gas. And yet for the LeConte to travel that same amount would take 376 gallons. So the savings to the state is significant, in my opinion, and that's the operations part, I think, that the AMHOB needs to take into account. If I'm not mistaken, the capital outlay is the capital outlay. That's sort of our job, wouldn't you say?
Through the chair, Representative McKay, I think what you're, well, first of all, again, statutory authority governing what we do, our responsibility is to ensure that there is a long-range plan in place and that the Alaska Marine Highway System is following that long-range plan. So that's kind of a baseline thing. I don't think that the question about capital allocation does inform long-range planning. And the items that were prioritized in the long-range plan and the other capital needs across the system, again, were prioritized as a part of that long-range plan. So once, again, the planning process, iteratively as you roll forward, things change, decisions get made. But the timing of this one was puzzling, I guess, to the board in the terms of the timing of the approval of the long-range plan and the acceleration of capital expenditure on Cascade.
Thanks.
That's really why that October letter came forward.
I'll save the rest of my questions to beat up Director Tornga.
Let's not beat anybody up today. Representative McCabe. Thank you, Ms. Ayers and Mr. Lindhoff, for joining us. Feel free to stay on the line in case there are questions that would be specifically relevant to AMHOB operations. And I would just like to offer a comment that from what you have said, it sounds like consideration of capital outlay isn't part of informed decision-making about operations, considering the very limited resources that AMHS has to work with. And so I want to express my appreciation for a full consideration when making decisions and recommendations. So at this time, I'd like to welcome our DOT folks to the table. Director Tornga, welcome. I know we also have Deputy Commissioner Keith with us and Legislative Director Andy Mills. And as needed, I'm sure we can swap folks in and out. I'd also just like to note for the committee and the public that are watching us today, we are, it sounds very likely, not going to get through this presentation today. And so I just want to offer an update that we're going to take our time on this one and most likely bring this back on Tuesday as well. So committee members can feel free to ask questions at their leisure. Thank you for being here.
And for the record, Catherine Keith, the Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And with me, I have the pleasure to introduce Craig Tornga, the Marine Director overseeing the Alaska Marine Highway System, as well as Andy Mills, a Legislative Liaison with the Department. And soon to come up will be Director Chris Goines. He's the Regional Director for the South Coast Region. We certainly do have an extensive slide deck, so please let us know how you'd like to proceed as we go through them and look forward to the dialogue. And with that, I'll go sit in the back. Thank you.
Good afternoon. For the record, Craig Tornga, the director for the Alaska Marine Highway. All right, our first slide here is kind of highlights what AMHOB has done in 25. I haven't quite been here 3 years yet, but starting in mid-23, started working with the board. I've enjoyed the time working with them. This whole time we've been working on the long-range plan. But specific to this slide for April of 25, you can see here for the quarterly AMHOB meeting what the board has done with the recommend to move forward with our five-year economic analysis. I also made the recommendation to retire the Matanuska from service after we presented the pretty ugly audio gauging report that, you know, showed all the wastage through the hole. It was everywhere through the hole and on the car deck. And then the Dom had presented a waterfall funding model, and they approve that model going forward. And then we are also doing MOUs with for our workforce initiatives with some of the tribal and Alaska Native groups, and they've proved proceeding with those MOUs as well. And then they gave their endorsement of the long-range plan at that point as well. In July, we had they requested and had a meeting with the DOT planning group as well to just see how our plan aligns with the DOT long-range plan of the AMHS and work through that process. We did that monthly with the DOT as well as we designed our plan to make sure we weren't getting off track and staying with the vision. They also reviewed with ADA, the Ketchikan Shipyard Ownership Change, again, the waterfall funding model, and then approved for us to continue looking at simultaneously at both options for getting a route to Canada. So we're looking at Prince Rupert Hyder at the same time, and we have some funding to continue with that. So they gave us that recommendation as well. And then October, this, as Juanetta just pointed out, they did request reconsideration on Cascade Point and some clarifications at that time.
We think we have a question here, Representative St. Clair.
Through the chair, thank you. I have a question on this waterfall funding model. Can you explain that to me, please?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative St. Clair. It's a type of financial model that just shows in kind of a waterfall. It's a vertical graph that shows the different segments of cost. And so when they're working on the budget, they can show that waterfall model. It's just a different way of looking at the finances.
Follow-up? Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, I was thinking that maybe that was the actual funding, any excess funding following over, because then there are statutory concerns, the sweep, and everything else. Thank you for clarifying that.
You bet.
I don't see any further questions here, so we can go to slide 3.
Thank you. Okay. The next slide, this one here is really talking about our long-range plan. We work the long-range plan. There's really four focus areas, and I actually conduct my presentation to the board every quarter in that same format for the four focus areas. The first area is service to our communities. It's the safe and reliable service. So I'll provide key performance indicators of where we're at on the safety side, where we are on the reliability side, and to make sure we're aligned with the vision. The second area we focus on is it's the operational system upgrades, it's the fleet upgrades, it's the terminal upgrades, it's everything around the management, the assets and the management, how we manage the business. And then the third focus area is our workforce, and we have a big focus on Alaska Hire and development of Alaska Mariners. And then on the financial side, our key performance indicator there is really our farebox recovery rate. And we're expanding that not just from a systems standpoint, but what we do by route. So the board went through, AMHOB went through, and they've given their recommendations on everything in the long-range plan here based on those four focus areas. This slide here really highlights the most engagement we did have with the board, because they really worked on our levels of service and for the different communities, how we looked at the communities. We looked at, did they have other alternatives of transportation? Are they relying completely on the ferry? As we work through this, the board really took the lead in this section, and we do this project through our first our quarterly board meetings we were having in late 23 and in the start of 24. I really appreciated their input on this. It was a heavy lift, and then we had a lot of meetings that we held. Very focused group meetings every quarter. We had some open houses meetings on the long-range plan. We had meetings here locally on workforce, and the board was very supportive in all those. They were on the calls here. Ed Page, when we had every meeting I had in Juneau, he showed up and was supportive and was willing to talk. And so I do want to thank the board for the engagement and on this as we work through the plan as well. You can see here from these bubbles here, just representing all the different feedback we did receive from the different communities. And I think we were pleasantly surprised when we did go out with the last community survey that we got 2,600 responses that people took the time, to fill that out. So we were very grateful for that. And so I just wanted to, point out it's you can see on the right side, it's some of the key feedback we did receive, and you can see the number one listed there is reliability. We heard that from everybody, and better planning. So it was good feedback for the whole report, and I appreciate the collaboration with the public and AMHOB in putting that all together.
And I would just like to pause here and Director Tornga, that's an incredible amount of community survey responses. Yeah. I know when we do public feedback on most anything as a state, we might be lucky if we get a few dozen. So this effort for public engagement is crucial. And I know reliability tops the list as the primary request from the public. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by reliability? Is that having consistent scheduling that's early noticed and people can know it's there? Is it having consistent service to communities that we are underserving right now? And just elaborate a little bit.
You bet. How do I respond to that? It's through to the co-chair. It's all of that, and it's also not having the service interruptions. So they need that reliability so they can plan. And then for the changes we've been trying to make on the reliability side is really we haven't, how Juanetta said, we have an aged fleet. But it doesn't mean we still can't do our maintenance and keep it up. Yeah, it has challenges. There are fatigue issues that sometimes will just, you know, pop up and hit us, unlike a newer vessel. But we do track our out-of-service time. You can track out-of-service many ways. You can track, you know, weather delays. You can track regulatory delays. But strategically, all I'm tracking is what the crews can control to some extent. And we need, as an employee, you want to see a win. And so what I have here is anything that's a mechanical breakdown that interrupts service, we track that out of service time. For 2025, we had a 98.55% uptime. And we reported on an uptime. It's a more positive number than a downtime. So that's from an industry standpoint, you know, you want to be above 98%. I usually have my fleet around 99 and a little over 99, and that's really kind of the goal. But I've never had a fleet that's had 50- and 60-year-old vessels before, so it is more of a challenge here. But that's a number the crews can really be proud of, and that reliability. So you try to build a reliability-centric culture, and that's what we're doing with recording our out-of-service time and our uptime so everybody can see it. We had to put in place a computer maintenance management system, a CMMS system. We didn't have that on the boat. So, I mean, there's some steps to get there. First, we had to have a server on the boat, and then we had to have Starlink on the boat, satellite, so we'd have a connection, and then we had the server where they could put the software package we bought and then implement this program, and the crews are doing a fantastic job with it. So it pops up, it has every component in there from a reliability standpoint. It's not just your main engines, got air compressors all the way down to the steering pump and what the OEM recommended service is for that, whether it's on hours or time, but it's all in there. And that hierarchy is built in there, thousands of parts, and then that all pops up and tells them, hey, you got this due today, you got that due today. And it gives them a dashboard to show what's been done, what's due, what's maybe past due, so we have all that. So that's the effort around the reliability. And like I say, I'm really focused on that side because it's what the crews can control.
Thank you. We have a question from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, Mr. Torunga, first of all, thank you for your service. Sounds like you are doing a great job, so thank you for being here. Looking at the public engagement, I guess my question is, you know, it looks great. What does that tell you, that level of public engagement?
Yeah, co-chair, well, you see the passion for this system. There's no doubt about it, and the engagement, and we get the feedback. But it, you know, as we interact with them, with each community, we do hear the importance and all the reasons of why they need the service, what they don't have in their community, and why they need to go somewhere else to get things done. You know, it's not just medical. It's, you know, a car repair, anything like that. You know, we get a lot of them towed on and put on. And then, you know, they want their grocery runs at different times. It's all understandable, but it's great to have that interaction with them. And a lot of what we hear is what they were used to and what they have today. I don't think we'll ever be back to what they used to have, but we're trying to build something that they can rely on today. And if you go through the long-range plan, it shows that Our fleet is actually a little smaller in the long-range plan, but the port calls are more because we put an effort into designing standardization in the fleet, standardization in the terminals, have an interchangeability around them so they're all can load by the stern or the side or discharge that way. And then it's not just the vessels, it's the terminals as well. The terminals, is, we have one-offs. You know, you can take Pelican. I got the Leconte that go there. No one else can. So when the Leconte couldn't get there in the wintertime, because it's a tough run to Pelican. You're going through icy straits, and then you got to go across Sound, which puts you right in the Gulf. And it's a pretty nasty run. And we couldn't get there for over a month. Seaplanes couldn't get there for a month. You probably saw Pelican was on the front page. But if we had a larger boat and a dock there that they could have tied up to, you know, an Alaska class may have made that run. But that's what we're trying to get into place is a standardization in the system. And it's not just Southeast. You know, I'd love to see, you know, in the plan we have a float going into Yakutat. So we're not just relying on the Kennecott. Any ocean class could get up there and go, and it goes to all our places.
Follow up. And Mr. Tornga, this is more or less a comment. I used to be a professional planner for the Mat-Su Borough, and I've worked on some plans, and that's a very impressive level of public engagement. And it obviously shows me that people care, but it also, that is the foundation for a long-range plan. A long-range plan is supposed to be a community's envisioned future for a system. And it's supposed to guide policymakers, so we use resources wisely and that we actually do what the public wants us to do. So I just want to make that comment, because if you don't have plans, well, when you build a house, it might not turn out the way you wish. So thank you, sir.
Co-Chair Eichheit, I have to say thank you, because my dream is this plan is followed. So I'm used to doing business plans. I've done them for years and interacted with boards on plans, get approval, and we have the discipline to stay with them. So I really, that's the dream here, is that we stay with this plan.
Mr. Mills.
For the record, Andy Mills, legislative liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. This is the excellent place to maybe put this context as well, especially for folks who haven't been as steeped in ferry as the rest of us. So there's a whole history that goes before this that is the MTAB, the Marine Transportation Advisory Board, the reshaping work group, which I just want to call out Ms. Ayers, Chair Ayers, and also Representative Stutes were on that effort. So that's the long time, a lot of work. And that spawned, of course, a recommendation that led to Representative Stutes, then Speaker Stutes, having HB 63, which then brought AMHOB. And codified that. And so this is all a lot of effort that led to the implementation of this long-range plan. And I would just note there's a lot of folks who, in many other contexts, will criticize the department for continuously studying rather than doing. And so as we have discussions today, note the time period of some of the conversations and planning that we have put into it. And in this long-range plan, it's time to act upon some of these. And that was, I believe, the reason that the HB 63 codified AMHOB as it was to get the ship out and going. So,
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So I'm going to change directions a little bit. I love the long range plan. That's awesome. How do you know it works? So my point being, and I'm going to make a business case again here, because airlines do it by business, and airlines are my background. So when they make a long-range plan, they know it works with money. So I don't see much in here about the fare box recovery and determining if your long-range plan is going to work if they're using it.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, if you look at not this PowerPoint, but the plan itself. We have a financial section in there, and it forecasts in there projected off of ridership historically, and in forecasting forward, we had economists work on that with us, McKinley Resource Group, and so we forecast forward the ridership and then the revenue. Now, what we did forecast in there was CPI adjustments annually going forward. since I've been here, there's not been a rate increase. When we modeled it out to year 2045 without the CPI adjustments, the gap between forecasted expenses and forecasted revenue grew $90 million over that 20 years. So the goal here is to keep this business viable. And so we've recommended, at a minimum, the CPI adjustment of the previous year. Last year was 2.1%. And going forward, and then when you model that out going forward, that gap does not grow.
Follow-up?
Thanks. And I appreciate that. So as a follow-up, and I think we all can agree that the ferry is probably never going to make money.
No.
We all understand that. It serves a great purpose. It serves our Southeast communities. But I think what we're – maybe farebox recovery was the wrong way to put it. Maybe ridership is more important. So farebox recovery, I don't care as much. But if you do a long-range plan and you plan to have go into a small village like Pelican or Angoon or somewhere and nobody's riding it, then the plan's not working. So how do we tell if the plan is working? Is it via ridership? Is that part of how you're going to tell how to change your schedules, how to modify the plan?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe. So the plan, first off, we're looking at the routing and each one of the vessels in the design. If you look at the 2045, there's only two vessels today that are still there in 2045, and it's the Tasleen and the Hubbard, and the rest of it's all newer fleet. It's designed to be more efficient. It's all diesel-electric designs. And it's, as we look at the different port calls, it's all based on forecasted ridership. As you know, the economic models don't show a lot of growth in some of the communities, but we based it off what the forecasted population is in each one of the communities. So the farebox recovery is actually based on ridership. So it's how many passengers were on there, how many vehicles, and then that's how you get to the farebox recovery. Right now, our farebox recovery is, right around 30%. It used to be a little bit higher. We'd like to see this get up around 40. And if you go look at the plan, if we stick with the CPI, we can see that we get ourselves back up around a 40% farebox recovery.
Fair enough. Thanks.
Please continue.
Okay. I believe.
Okay, and for the record, Catherine Keith. So I wanted to highlight the currently approved Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan. This is from back in 2004. We are currently updating it and look forward to having this out for review closer to the middle and have it final near the end of the year. But the Southeast Transportation Plan, SEATP, it really launched this bold vision on how we can improve the efficiency of travel throughout Southeast Alaska. It included a combination of course, ferry access and also road connections were evaluated in order to find ways that we could leverage some of the existing forestry roads, old logging roads that had these 4407 easements on them, to combine road access in order to shorten ferry routes to get those operating costs down and have several other benefits from that. So as we start to talk about our plans and the plans that define how the department has shaped transportation priorities for capital investment, these plans are an important part of that.
Actually, can we go back?
Yeah.
Deputy Commissioner, and this road extensions that allow ferries to operate shorter routes, what were some of the specific requests from that 2004 document? Or were there any specific road extensions requested? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. And there are three following slides that speak specifically to these connections. That if it's okay to proceed with those, it's visually helpful.
We do have a question from Representative Mina.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, just a general question about the Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan. So this is from 2004, so it's a document from over 20 years ago. I wasn't there. I don't know if you were there, but do you know about the public engagement of this plan? Because I'm just thinking when we're talking about building roads and attachment to the ferry system, making sure that that is accessible for people who can't drive.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Through the co-chair, Carrick, Representative Mina. Yeah, I certainly wasn't there in 2004, but I would assume, just given the high amount of engagement that always occurs with transportation plans, especially involving the ferry system, that it was extensive, but we can get you that documentation for it. But it was certainly like these recommendations that are being made to evaluate the potential for road service, not that that's the exclusive way to travel, but that it would open up further opportunities for people to travel. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So one of the recommended routes was looking at Sitka and the road access, the potential access within Sitka. Director Tornga here can speak a little bit to the challenges of getting in and out of Sitka, but currently when the ferry goes through, it has to go through the Sergius Narrows, which has some complications with tidal fluctuations and other things. So looking at the possibility of having a ferry terminal more on the northeast side of Baranoff Island would allow a ferry from Juneau to go directly across Chatham Strait and from there be able to provide much more frequent service compared to what's currently available in Sitka. And again, you know, some of the benefits here may be pretty straightforward. As Representative McCade had mentioned, that when we can get the fuel consumption down, the amount of crew time down per route, it begins to make significant impact on operating budgets. But Director Torng, any follow-up on this one?
Yeah, for the record, Craig Torng, just as was pointed out, right now we have the mainliner going there, and they consume the most fuel for getting there. If we had something that got over to the east side of Baranoff, then we can service that with one of our day boats that are a lot more efficient. And then it depending on where you come out, you know, we're not recommending a route. There's like three different routes that the community's looked at or DOT's looked at. But if we got to the other side, it lines up for calling at places like Angoon and also to Cake. And so it just makes our whole routing more efficient if we get, a road across the island. And when I mention this, when I'm in the communities and like Cake, or they say, we want to go to Sitka because they know that the regional Native hospital is going to be built in Sitka, so that would really improve access to and from Sitka for everybody.
Yeah, we have a couple questions here. I've kind of put myself in the queue as well. My understanding is it's about 16 miles across the island from one side to the other over to Chatham Strait. What is the winter maintenance and operations and staffing costs look like? Not to mention the build costs for a road that goes right across the island. If you could kind of opine on that.
Yeah, Co-Chair Carrick, and for the record, Catherine Keith, yeah, we can certainly provide some average dollar amounts for maintenance and operations in the winter of roads that are more the frontier style across rural Alaska. But what we are proposing as we move forward into the next four-year statewide transportation improvement program is to actually complete those preliminary reconnaissance studies that haven't necessarily been done or aren't as current to help answer some of those questions, to get to the capital cost and what maintenance and operations would look like, what type of maintenance station would be needed in order to ensure that access. So we look forward to having public comment back on those feasibility, like they'd be reconnaissance studies in the next four-year step.
Okay, and it's my understanding, just not being from Southeast, that side where the road would come out is of Baranoff Island is uninhabited. There's not like directly communities over there at this time. So we would functionally have a 16-mile, if this were to go through, we would functionally have a 16-mile road to a ferry terminal and would have to cover M&O for that. It doesn't, the road itself wouldn't be going from one community to another community.
That's correct. And for the record, Craig Tarnga, I think you can look at Metlakatla, and the road was put over to Annette Bay, and that's a 15-mile road. And, yeah, there's that cost. It's, you know, I haven't been here for those studies, but I understand in talking to the community there, you know, that was a real change to think we were going to run out there. But overall, it's less cost than a ferry running that same route over and over.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Yeah, so a mainliner is about 394 gallons an hour. Is that it sound about right? Somewhere in there?
You're pretty close, yes.
Yeah, so, and we would need to make a business case, obviously, and how much time you're saving, plus it's actually more time because you're going through the Sergius Narrows, right? So, and yeah. It goes slower. It doesn't obviously go at the max speed, right? Yep. So what about a bus? 16 miles on a bus. So I get that people don't want to drive their cars. They don't want to stay over there. They don't want to burn their fuel when they're paying for a ferry ticket. So you envision that maybe the ferry system will have a bus that will go out to the ferry terminal from somewhere in Sitka maybe? Or if we're talking Cascade Point, when we get to that 35-ish miles, 32 miles, would we be running a bus, do you think, from Juneau or from the ferry terminal now and save these poor people the 2 gallons worth of gas so that we can save 366 gallons or whatever, 376 gallons of state gas?
Yeah, and through the co-chair, Representative McCabe, for the record, Catherine Keith. Yes, absolutely. And looking back to Metlakatla, it's very similar. The Mayor Smith had been looking at what it would take to, for the, in that case, not the Marine Highway System, although that could be done, but in that case, it'd be the Native Village of Metlakatla, have a bus or a shuttle that they could then bring people over, drive that on the Latuya, and from there be able to go through Ketchikan. So, yeah, absolutely.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Please continue.
Yeah, another example of a similar connector would be on Kupernoff Island, and that would allow us to look at some of the connections. You see out here we have Cake and Petersburg. And so the previous conversations had been about pulling those ferry terminals together, so ultimately having a new ferry facility, you know, somewhere there in the northeast side. This allows the same benefits in being able to reduce the amount of vessel miles by having the road there in place. And again, I'll hand it to Director Tornga. Any comments on this?
Yes, for the record, Craig Tornga. This road, they have a partial road this going this direction already from Cake towards Petersburg. And what this does allow, right now we get service to Cake, you know, once, one round trip a month in the wintertime. It's not what we'd like to see, not what they're used to. But if they had a road that got over to Petersburg, then they could at least access Alaska Airlines, a major airline that goes in and out every day, that they don't have that right now. And it could access the mainliner, which goes through Petersburg northbound once a week and southbound once a week. So it would give Cake better access for air and the ferry travel.
I apologize to hog the mic today to the committee members, but I guess I have a general question looking at these slides. What's the average cost to build roads on these Southeast Alaska islands? I mean, we're talking about mountains and previously roadless areas in a region that's largely difficult to get materials and supplies to. My understanding is it in Sitka there was a road built in the previous 4 years or so that was about $70 million for 7 miles of road. So what's the cost of building roads across Kupernoff Island, for example?
Yeah, Co-Chair Carrick, for the record, Catherine Keith. What's interesting about these islands is that there are existing logging roads, the forestry roads that the state actually has easements through. So there wouldn't necessarily be a similar comparison to other road construction projects in Southeast, but we could certainly pull a list and have some of those proposed costs. And, you know, we can circle back to that, but this would be another example of where, through a reconnaissance study, we could get more specifics, looking at exactly the status of these logging roads, where material sites may be, what some of the logistics are getting in and out for construction.
That would be great, because, you know, we're talking about cost savings in relation to some of these projects, but state has a limited capacity for new capital projects right now, and we're not talking about going across a flat plain. We're talking about going across major mountainous island terrain, so it would be interesting to see some of those costs laid out more. Representative McCabe?
So we're totally going to shift positions here, Co-Chair Carrick, and what about the cost to the environment of running a ferry? I mean, when we do the business case, and we talk about 394 gallons an hour and burning fuel. What about the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere with the ferries versus what we're putting into the atmosphere with a bus or with a car driving on the logging roads?
Yeah, through the co-chair, Representative McCabe. Yeah, and we can absolutely do those calculations. We've done that for the Cascade Point Ferry Terminal and the reduced number of miles that the ferry would have to travel, and it's a significant carbon emissions reduction.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Just had to, didn't she, Representative McCabe? Please continue. Thank you, Director Tornga.
Okay.
So the last example to talk about right here is the in Chichagof Island, where you have Pelican, Huna, as well as, Tenneke Springs. And with these three communities here, again, they definitely don't have the service and frequency of service that they do need. This allows us that opportunity if we have, you know, a ferry terminal at either one of these locations or a more central one to be able to achieve these same goals. And as we, well, before I move on, Director.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for the record, Craig Tornga. This road is one that we recommended from Tenneke Springs to Huna. It does shorten our run as we make runs to Huna, and then we have to make about a 2-hour and 45-minute diversion down to Tenneke Springs and then back up. There is an old logging trail that goes there now, and we'd love to see that updated so we could be more efficient in our routing if there was a road between Huna and Tenneke Springs. So it's just, Co-Chair Carrick, you asked a lot of good questions about the cost of these roads. And as we developed our plan, admittedly, we didn't look at the cost of the roads. We were making recommendations that made AMHS more efficient going forward, and so we have a more affordable operation going forward. So it is a study that still has to be done. We recommend them to the DOT, and the DOT will be looking at that if it is a viable option or not.
Co-Chair Aishai.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, so again, my apologies for my geographic knowledge of Southeast. I represent Northeast Anchorage, but it is a beautiful area. But I've heard of an area here in Southeast called Kaufman Cove, and I believe that was a place where the ferry terminal was far from the nearest town that the ferry would service, and that it ultimately was shuttered, was closed, that ferry terminal. So I guess, isn't there a risk when you move the ferry terminal further from the community it serves that it may have issues with its economy?
Yeah, Co-Chair Aishai. Yes, I was before my time that one, but I've been asked about that terminal many times. It was really put in place for the IFA, and they were going to be making runs from there. It's a smaller harbor. We can't go into the harbor with our larger boats. But they did make some runs out of there, and as you pointed out, then it wasn't viable for them going forward. So that terminal is there, but it wasn't a part of the AMHS terminal at that time.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I might be getting a little bit ahead of myself, but I heard you say that on some of these, in looking at cost savings, you haven't factored in the roads. Does that mean that the roads and the bridges and all the safety issues going out to Cascade Point have not been factored in as well in the costs?
Through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, I believe the comment Director Torngo was referencing was in the AMHS long-range plan, the 2045 long-range plan. In that plan, there is a recommendation to evaluate road connections that would allow us to reduce the time where possible for on these longer ferry runs. In that plan, the cost, capital costs of the road construction projects were not included in that plan. And also, they didn't change any forecasted service levels based on this. It was merely this recommendation continuing on the Southeast Alaska plans that we do look at what it would take to build in connections to communities by road. And as we go through the Cascade Point slides that are coming up, you'll see the analysis that does include operating costs of that ferry terminal and the changes that you see by having that terminal at Cascade Point, as well as we have capital costs for construction. So,
follow up.
Thank you. So let me ask a very simple question. Was in Cascade Point, has the cost of the roads and the bridges and whatever is going to be necessary to facilitate finishing the roads out to Cascade Point, has that been taken into consideration with the numbers that have been currently presented?
Through the co-chair, Carrick, Representative Stutes, and I know you really like yes or no answers.
I certainly would.
In the operating analysis, the economic analysis recently completed by Ed King, that did not include the capital costs. We know what those are. It was not included in that economic analysis.
So the simple answer is no.
To whether or not it's in the Ed King analysis,
I'm not talking about Ed King. I'm talking about the numbers that have thus been provided.
Through the co-chair, Carrick, Representative Stutes, the department has provided the full project benefit cost analysis to the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board going back to 2022. So yes, we have provided them. Just depends on the study or specific presentation you're referencing.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
I give up. No, thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
Co-chair,
I should. Through the co-chair, I heard no, and then I heard yes.
Yeah, through co-chair, Carrick, co-chair Eichheit. It depends on the report that you're looking at. That's all I'm saying. There was one report that was evaluating the operating benefits of the Cascade Point Ferry Terminal, what you would see in cost savings because of the shorter ferry route. That is operating only, and we caveat it in that study, so it's very clear that it doesn't include the capital cost of that. We can include those calculations very easily in a separate or additional analysis. It's just, I think, in the report that Representative Stutes is referencing, those costs were not, they were intentionally not included as part of the operating costs because we wanted to understand if there was operating cost savings.
Follow up.
That's all.
Follow up, and we're going to take that one more question, yeah, and then we're going to have to adjourn today.
So, with all due respect, that was a... I did hear no, and then I heard yes, and then there was a lot of words there. I guess maybe is what I got out. So I just want you to know that was a confusing answer for me. So
yeah,
thank you.
Co-chair Carrick, co-chair Eichheit. Yeah, I apologize for being unclear. The department has the full capital costs of the build-out. We've shared those publicly. We also have the full operational savings of the system, and we've shared those publicly.
I'm also hearing yes, no. So I think maybe if the department could follow up in writing with the committee to better outlay some of the answers you've provided. Representative Stutes,
Absolutely.
Did you have another comment?
No, thank you. Appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Representative Mina, last question, and then we are going to adjourn today.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, as you do follow up with the committee on including those capital costs, if that information could also include the funds to maintain the capital infrastructure related to the project, that would be great. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Stutes.
Thank you. To add to that, if you could include the cost that we will be paying to lease the land that you want to build the ferry dock on, that would be appreciated as well.
Yeah, I would say a 1 to 2 page document that pretty clearly identifies the costs would be really helpful for the committee members. Thank you, Ms. Keith. Thank you, Director Tornga, for being here today. Thank you to all the members of the public who have come. This is clearly a really important topic for our whole state in the big picture, but especially for Southeast, and I appreciate the engagement. We will continue this discussion right here on slide 8 going forward at our next committee meeting, which will be on Tuesday, February 10th at 1:30 p.m. We have to accommodate, again, our House Finance Subcommittee meeting. We will be here in room 124, and at that hearing we will simply be continuing and finishing our presentation on this Cascade Point project. And again, thank you for being here today. At 2:58 p.m., House Transportation is adjourned.